Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Katarina Canuti, and you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport, and introduced this week by Katarina Canuti, 11 years of age, whose dad, Dean Canuti, bought her the opportunity to introduce the Tennis Podcast. I mean, at 11 years old, Catherine Whittaker, imagine if you'd been given a gift like that.
It's too much too soon, David, isn't it? Where does she go from here?
Wimbledon champion, I say. I mean, that's really all that could match up. So, you know, anyway, as you can tell, I'm pretty jolly because I've just been on holiday, which is why we did the listener special last week. Catherine is about to go on holiday in about 6 hours' time. We come to you at about 10 o'clock in the evening on Sunday night here. We've had a full day of tennis to follow. Catherine's been commentating today. We've got loads to talk about because we've got the whole Wimbledon Q conversation that we had last week. Some more on that. We've got the Davis Cup to catch up on that we weren't able to talk about last week because we weren't here, or rather I wasn't, because I had my feet up on a deck chair. Do they have deck chairs anymore? No, they didn't where I was anyway, in Croatia. We're going to talk about Monte Carlo, the Djokovic Marion Vida reconnection, because that's happened. We're going to talk about Kyle Edmund. We're going to talk about my text conversation with Sue Barker.
Absolutely. Oh, you've dropped that bomb early, David.
Absolutely, definitely going to talk about that. We'll also talk about the greatest performance by a player on his or her least favourite surface. What's your least favourite surface, Catherine?
I would say the answer to that question is me at the Royal Albert Hall 4 years ago when I beat you. Was it 4 years ago?
Yes, it was 4 years ago, yeah. That's your least favourite. Yeah.
Whittaker on a low bouncing indoor court. No, I mean, I quite like an indoor court generally, but that one was challenging.
Yes, it was challenging. So you've been commentating
for various
today.
Reasons. Yeah.
What were you commentating on today?
I was commentating on the final of the Samsung Open in Lugano, Switzerland, which I'm reliably informed is, generally speaking, a beautiful, picturesque place. To me, all week, it's looked like somewhere that's sort of experiencing some sort of biblical type flooding incident, because it has rained so torrentially all week. I mean, it really was one of those tournaments where it got to Thursday and you thought, hang on a second, they might actually just not get this done. It was Thursday and they were still playing qualifying, so somehow they got it done on time. They had to play the quarters and the semi-finals in one day. Now both of the finalists, Elise Mertens and Aryna Sabalenka, were also in the doubles final. So on the Saturday, Elise Mertens, the eventual Samsung Open champion, played 5 hours and 55 minutes of tennis, ending at about 9 o'clock at night. So 4 hours 41 of that was singles, and the other hour and a quarter was doubles. And then she had to come back the next day at 2:15 and play the final. And it was disgusting, David. She looked fresh as a daisy. It was ridiculous. She won the final, straight sets. Sabalenka, not at her best. She'll have to wait a bit longer for her first WTA title. But she's only 19. It'll come, without question. But Elise Mertens, she's not exactly a battle axe of a woman. You wouldn't look at her and think, you know, strong as an ox necessarily. But my goodness me, she honestly, you would never have known, not even a hint of it. Maybe if it had gone to three, you would have started to see it. But I don't know. She looked like she could have gone all day to me. And that's her third WTA title, her first on clay. She came into the week 20 in the world, which is obviously where she was propelled to as a result of that Australian Open semi-final run. But there's not a lot that can go wrong in Elise Mertens' game. You know, she doesn't have big weapons. It's not necessarily blockbuster tennis, but I don't see her going anywhere anytime soon. I don't think she's necessarily a top five Grand Slam champion tennis player, although stranger things have happened. But I think she is going to stick around in the world's top 20, top 15, maybe top 10, given the changeability in tennis at the moment. So, yeah, she's the real deal, I think. And I'm pleased for her that she's shown everyone that the Australian Open wasn't a flash in the pan. Incidentally, just one final thing I wanted to mention without comment, perhaps comment isn't needed, is that did you see any of the Samsung Open, David?
I saw about four games, yes. I thought I'd check out your commentary.
Four games worth of rain.
Yeah.
You caught an unrainy four games?
I did catch an unrainy four games, but that's because you told me it was about to start because you were commentating on it.
Right. So on the court, to the right and left, respectively, of the two players' chairs, it was just a big washing machine. I kid you not. I mean, I know, presumably that has something to do with the electronic sponsor, but Samsung make a lot of great stuff, David. They made my phone very successfully. I've got a great Samsung phone. Have a big,
and she expects a new one.
Have a big phone on the court. Have an iPad, not an iPad, you know, have a non-Apple iPad. What else does Samsung make? Loads of great stuff. Don't have a flipping washing machine.
I mean, you know, they could have had a vacuum cleaner.
An implement with slightly less sexist 50s housewife undertones. I don't know if that's what was going on. Did Samsung sponsor any men's events? Will there be washing machines on the court there?
Oh, come on. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. It was a weird look. It was a weird, weird look. They were sat on like plinths. It was like they were the trophy, except they weren't the trophy because there was a proper trophy. I genuinely thought during the trophy ceremony earlier they might get handed one of these washing machines.
She got
a lovely Rado watch instead. She looked
70s
she looked very
game
relieved.
Shows where they say to Aryna Sabalenka, have a look at what you could have won.
Cuddly toy, holiday to Las Vegas, washing machine. Oh. Anyway, it was just, you know.
Sensational.
It was a lovely event. Some great tennis. Beautiful setting when it's not raining. Weird washing machines.
Yes. Okay.
That's my summary of the Samsung Open.
Yes, it's a memory to take with us forever. So that's happened. And what else has happened today? Carl Edmund has been in his first ATP final, Catherine. Didn't go particularly well. Lost 6-2, 6-2 to Pablo Andujar, who I remember from Queens about 4 years ago when he came on during the French Open final and he was talking to BBC Radio as they were commentating live, just building up to Nadal against Djokovic. And he was at Queens for the first round of that. And he came on to just tell us all of his Nadal stories. And my word, what a charming bloke he was. Well, he's had a horrible time since then. He's had three elbow surgeries and just really nice to see him back out there playing well. He's won 10 matches in a row now. But that's a chastening defeat, really, for Kyle Edmund. I mean, I as an experience, at least. But then I always feel with Kyle Edmund, this sort of thing happens, and then he just starts building and learning and not doing it next time.
Trivia for you, David. Trivia question. Pablo Andujar are ranked 360-something, I think, in the world. Lowest ranked ATP World Tour title winner since. Since Ooh. Blank in blank.
That's a good one.
Come on, David.
Is it Martin Verkerk?
It's not. It's not. I see what you've done there. I mean, in pointless terms, that would definitely be a pointless answer. Martin Verkerk, always a pointless answer.
Does
America have pointless? What kind of country wouldn't have pointless? It's a game show, anyway, for anyone wondering what I'm on
this
about.
This podcast
Incidentally,
is relatively
I was watching Pointless the other day, and Jamie Delgado was a pointless answer, and I thought, poor Jamie.
Go on, Jamie.
anyway, back on track. Since blank in blank. I'll give you one more guess.
Oh, for goodness sake.
I'll give you one more. I'm just buying time so I can go back through the annals of my glorious Martin Verkerk memories.
How far back are we going? How many years?
In very much in my lifetime and in my tennis enjoying lifetime.
Right, okay. Well, I don't know who it is. So there we are. No, hold on a minute. It must be... somebody really famous who's been out of the game for a long time, isn't it?
It is someone really famous.
Excellent. It is Roger Federer.
Roger Federer. No. It was a relatively late bloomer, David. What are you on about? It was Leighton Hewitt in 1998.
I told you it was somebody. That's not fair. He was 16. Oh, yeah. What was he ranked?
More than 360-something.
All right, so you don't know. Okay, so that happened. And and so Kyle Edmund, not a great day for him, but I'm sure he'll come again.
I don't want to detract from the positivity. I generally overall feel positive about Kyle Edmund, and it took him, that was his sixth bite at the semi-final cherry, wasn't it, for before he made it through to final. So that's a big step in itself. But 2-2, that is a pretty disastrously bad performance, isn't it? I mean, in terms of an opportunity to get your first tour title on the board, all due respect to Pablo Andujar, 10-match winning streak and everything, they don't come much better than that. So I do think,
he played
overall, upon reflection... positive week, and I think really, really good call by him and his team to go to Marrakesh and to start the clay court season getting some match wins under his belt. I do think today and for a couple of days he'll probably be pretty gutted about that because it's a big opportunity. Incidentally, David, just quickly, on a technology note, where did you watch Carl Edmund's matches in Marrakesh?
On a washing machine. No, I watched it on Facebook. Ah, yes, I've learned how to use Facebook now. And
we've been transported to the future, David. We're watching tennis on Kyle Edmund's Facebook page.
Are there not, though, now kitchen appliances on which you can watch stuff on Facebook?
What are you talking about? Are you talking about Alexa?
No, I'm sure there are like fridge freezers that have got screens on them and
what are you talking about? I mean, maybe.
You've been shopping in the wrong shops, Catherine.
Let's find out. What were we talking about? Facebook. Watching tennis on Facebook. Yeah, I feel like... it's a fantastic deal, arrangement that they've come to. I think it's through British Airways, isn't it? One of Kyle Edmund's new sponsors. They've done a deal with Facebook... an incredible coup. He's not the only player to have done it, but incredible coup. It bypasses all regional and rights-based issues. So wherever you are in the world, you can watch all Kyle Edmund matches on his Facebook page, which, yeah, is an incredible coup. But I really... Who knew that we all wanted to be watching our sport on Facebook? I mean, I don't think it's any secret that Facebook are planning... to get into more live sport, aren't they? So maybe this is a toe in the water.
It's going that way, but equally, I think that they are able to geographically block and decide where you are able to watch it and where you're not. And it is only Marrakesh. But there we are, yeah. I tell you, there's so much
control.
Oh,
no, I thought it was an ongoing deal. It wasn't just Marrakesh.
No, no. Well, I mean, it might be other events as well, but it's not like every Kyle Edmund match for eternity is going to be available on Facebook. It's not. That's not the way it's going to work.
I misunderstood. I got carried away.
But still, it's quite good, and it's happened this week. In Houston, we have a final going on, I think, between Tennis Sandgren. And who's he playing? I can't remember who he's playing now. Is it Steve Johnson? I think it is.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is Steve Johnson.
They haven't finished yet. That's about all I got for you from this week. Catherine, the Monte Carlo tournament is about to get underway. Just before we talk about that, I mentioned last week Davis Cup we didn't get to talk about, and it was one of those that everybody's very excited who is against the ITF proposals to change the Davis Cup and have it all in a single week at the end of the year. Everybody who is against that idea was using the Spain against Germany tie as the example of why Davis Cup must not change, because it was magical, it was wonderful, it was a bull ring, it was 3-2, it had Zverev and Nadal playing, so all the big names were out, and Spain ended up winning, they're through to the semi-finals. Did it alter your thinking in any way?
No, because nothing has changed. Absolutely nothing has changed. We learnt nothing new What that tie in Valencia was, and it was glorious, was evidence of what we already knew, that the Davis Cup can be magical and spectacular and watchable, and it can be the best thing in tennis. But it still needs reform. This tie had all the big names, but one of the reasons the tournament needs reform is that there's no reliability in the participation of the top players. It doesn't mean there's never participation of top players. Obviously, there can be, but it's all. It's more evidence of how important it is to reform in the right way, to try and preserve as many of the things that were wonderful about that tie. And it did exude pretty much everything that's brilliant about the Davis Cup. Preserve as many of them as you possibly can whilst reforming. There was nothing new about that tie. We knew the Davis Cup could be spine tingling and brilliant. And that's all the more reason to try and preserve it as such for the future. You can't have everything. You know, the tennis world has changed, and the Davis Cup needs to change with it.
Yes, it does. At least I think we think so. But
interesting, just quickly, David, interesting that Nadal, subsequent to that tie, has committed to playing the Davis Cup for the remainder of the year, obviously injury permitting. Spain now have a tie against France, a semi-final tie against France. So he'll play in that, provided he's fit, and in a final should there be one. But also that he's lent his support to the reforms. So, yeah, I mean, one thing, his commitment to it, I suppose some people, naysayers of the reforms, could use as evidence that the reforms aren't needed, because, you know, we're still getting the world number one participating even as it stands at the moment. But then also Nadal is supportive of the reforms. So just a couple of interesting nuggets, David.
Indeed. Elsewhere, though, the United States won through very straightforwardly 3-0. And by stark contrast, I mean, I think there was about 4,000 or 5,000 people watching that. Nothing like the same degree of atmosphere. They are through, though, to the semi-finals and will play against Croatia away. Croatia winning through handily with Marin Cilic and Borna Coric. And
if you're, quickly, David, if you're Mr. France and Mr. Croatia, and you practically are Mr. Croatia, what surface are you picking for those two ties? They're the two home sides. What surfaces are you picking?
I'm going quick indoors, certainly from a France perspective, certainly, because they're going to just want to make Nadal as uncomfortable as they possibly can. And a fast indoor surface, I think, is their best chance of doing so, specifically because they have so many different players that they could use who can all play on that sort of surface. You wouldn't touch clay with a barge pole, would you? If you were France in that tie, whereas they have in previous ties. Most recently, we recall wasn't the Davis Cup final played on that? I think it was.
It was, yeah.
And also playing against Britain last year, but they won't do that this time. And I would have thought that Croatia, who I've seen beat the United States in Croatia in a Davis Cup tie 16 years ago when James Blake was playing and Mario Ancic, players like that, and Ivan Ljubicic, who was brilliant, I think that they will go probably fairly quick indoors as well. Maybe not quick, but indoors I would have thought that they would both go.
Mr. Croatia speaketh.
Yes, people are getting very excited.
The entire nation is listening, David.
I was in Croatia when they were playing that tie, and yes, people were quite into it. So anyway, we'll look forward to seeing those two ties in September. They take place now. Other things that we have got to talk to you about today before we go on to the Wimbledon queue conversation, which has taken up quite a lot of my time on Twitter over the last week, polls and all sorts. We've got Monte Carlo about to start. A spectacular event. It started today. I never quite know whether it's starting on a Sunday or a Monday. It feels pretty low key today by contrast to you know, a Monday start. I'm not a particularly big fan of Sunday starts myself. The big story, really, aside from Rafael Nadal trying to win his 88th Monte Carlo title, is Novak Djokovic, who has got another new stroke old coach in Marijan Vida. And he's basically gone back to the bloke who he separated from when Boris Becker had got ditched or separated from him. Then Marijan Vida left, wasn't that? I think that was the shock therapy moment, wasn't it? When he just got rid of everybody on his team, and then he went Andre Agassi, and he went Radek Stepanek. He was very nice about Stepanek. He was pretty terse about Agassi. That clearly hasn't ended particularly well. And here we are with Marijan Vida, albeit on a temporary basis, from what we hear. But I would have thought that is the old coat that he's putting on that makes him feel like he did when he won a gazillion Grand Slam titles.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought it felt a little bit like baby out with the bathwater when Djokovic ditched him a year or so ago. I mean, I didn't quite understand that at the time. But then, as we discussed on last week's podcast, there's plenty of coaching decisions, big and small, that I don't understand, and I don't expect to, because most of what goes on between player and coach goes on behind closed doors. So I think it's as good a plan as any. I think that the issues with Novak Djokovic, and again, I'm not privy to all of them, but I get the impression they're so multifaceted that there is no one thing that's going to magically make everything click and make everything like it was. But this seems as good a thing to try as any. I think, you know, there are obviously injury issues, but there's also confidence issues and comfort issues, I think, with being on the court and getting used to not being the omniscient, you know, top seed, and getting someone back that, as you say, feels like your favourite old comfort blanket. I certainly don't think it can do any harm, and I can absolutely see why he's trying it. I just don't think it's going to be a magic wand. I don't think there necessarily is a magic wand for Djokovic. It's going to be interesting. He has an awful draw in Monte Carlo. So,
I mean, who's organised that draw?
It is
nobody
dreadful.
Has, in honesty, because it's not fixed. But, I mean, come on, karma. That's not on, is it? I mean, he's ended up with a qualifier in the first round, Borna Coric in the second round, if all goes as one would expect. And then he's got Dominic Thiem in round three, and then Rafael Nadal in the quarters to try to get to the semi-finals. I mean, that is as tough as it gets.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, there are some tough qualifiers as well. I don't know if I presume they have actually now done the qualifying draw, but Andres Seppi has qualified, Stefanos Tsitsipas has qualified, Pierre Hugerbert, Jeremy Shardy, Dusan Lajovic. They're all qualifiers.
Well, actually, and did you know that Andreas Seppi is Kyle Edmund's first round opponent now because there's been a withdrawal? And Stefano Tsitsipas, he of the glorious single-handed backhand from Greece, is up against Denis Shapovalov. How about that?
Oh, I love that. I don't want either of them to lose.
Set your video. Do people
it's
do
live.
That?
It's Djokovic has got Lajovic, incidentally, so an all-Serbian tussle. But he's no slouch on the clay, Lajovic, and he'll have played himself in.
Oh, no, he's good on clay, isn't he?
Couple of qualies matches, I think that's really tough.
Yeah.
And it doesn't get any easier. So look, if he falls early this week, it could very well be down to the draw. There's no question. But it is an interesting one, Monte Carlo, because he lives in Monte Carlo. The Monte Carlo Country Club is practically his home club. That's where he trains a lot of the time. That whole place is like a comfort blanket to him. So if it goes wrong there, it could do quite further damage, I think, to his mental state. I don't know. It depends how and why, and maybe the tough draw takes the pressure off a bit. Maybe it does. I don't know. As I say, it's also multifaceted. It's sort of difficult to speculate about one factor and another factor, and because it's just an interwoven jigsaw puzzle of a conundrum.
Blimey, that sounds complicated. I'm really confused.
I'm glad I'm not Marion Vida trying to. Yeah, I mean, do you, if you're Marion Vida, do you, he's very sort of spiritual and philosophical and all of that, Djokovic, isn't he? So I wonder if, you know, going back to VAR, it's definitely going back, isn't it? It's like, remember how, I'm sure you vividly do remember how shocked I was that Murray went back to Lendl. Now, obviously, I turned out to be so massively wrong about that. It's untrue. But I was really shocked, as much as Lendl's a great coach and they work well together, I was just shocked that he looked backwards, because these sports people, they always talk about, you know, always looking ahead, looking to the future, just, you know, never look backwards or dwell on things. Or so, and this is very much the
same. I don't look at it like
that. It's a backward glance. So
no, it's not.
Trying to refine the Djokovic of old rather than a reinvented new and improve Djokovic, do you know what I mean? Or is this as I'm saying it, it sounds like guff. It sounds like waff.
It's utter absurdity when you consider that it worked so wonderfully well for Ivan Lendl and Andy Murray.
Well, I've already said that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Wrong, and my point is that you're not looking back. You're looking back to look forwards. That's what you're doing. That's what you're doing.
Goodness me, you're profound, David.
I tell you, but it's true. I know all about this. So anyway, That's all happened and is still to come in Monte Carlo. We'll keep a close eye on that and tell you what happens next week in Monte Carlo. So what else have we been talking about over the last week? Well, one of the big...
Hang on a second, what? David. We just breezed past that with that prediction. Who's going to win Monte Carlo?
That bloke Nadal.
I suspect we're going to be hearing a lot of that flavour of prediction.
He hasn't actually won 88 of them. He's won 10 of them, but that's quite a lot. So it just feels like 88. So Nadal will win the French Open and Barcelona and Monte Carlo and everything is my
Plus
prediction.
Plus ça change, David.
Yes,
ça change.
I've really worked or hard to that, come up with that.
Maybe that will change.
We'll see. What do you think?
I mean, you can't not predict Nadal, can you? So Nadal, but I'm interested. He would play team in the
semis.
I know team's a total unknown quantity in himself.
He's been injured.
Very injured. Apparently he was hitting well, but you know what we think about when people say he's hitting well.
Who's been saying
tennis,
that?
Tennis player hits tennis ball well.
Yeah.
Headline news.
Yeah, very good that.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Wimbledon, the queue. Last week, that was our big debating point because it was prompted by our listener question special, Leah, throwing in that question about the Wimbledon queue. And we ran a big old pole vault in the last week, you'll be delighted to know, and 1,200 people entered. 51% of people think get rid of the queue. 49%.
When we talked about this earlier, David, it was 52-48.
Well, it's moved.
Have you doctored the needle? Doctored the stats?
No, people have just, you know, piled in on keep
massaged
it.
Massaged the figures.
They've said it's magical. Style. So anyway, there's plenty of people still want to keep it, and plenty of people don't. Catherine, you were one of the people that thought get rid.
Yes, and I think pitting those two points of view actually is a bit of a misdirection, because I also think it's magical, or certainly can be magical. I think individuals can have a magical experience of it. I know you had a pretty magical experience the first time you did it. I'm not for a moment going to tell people that had a magical experience, no, it wasn't magical, it's a dreadful thing. It absolutely can be magical. I did it for the first time when I was 16. It wasn't quite magical. I do look back on it fondly.
Now that you're in the safe, dry weather.
Now I'm in the safe, dry weather. I mean, I was a bit, I don't know what came over me. My usually very responsible parents allowed me to set off for Southwest London with nothing more than a a sleeping bag and a spare pair of pants. I mean, not even a tent. And in those days, you weren't in the park; you slept on the street. So I don't know what we were thinking. But it was an experience, and it's created a great memory. And look, I'm not questioning that it can be a great experience. I just think there are bigger concerns than that at play. I think Wimbledon is the most iconic, to a lot of people, the most special tennis event, some would say sporting event, in the world. And it's a really powerful, powerful tool in converting people, in making people fall in love with this sport. And I don't think you can ever be complacent about that. You know, numbers.
So how does the current system stop people from falling in love with the sport? There's only 500 people queuing for centre court. The rest is going, most of the rest of it goes in a ballot.
It is unintentionally exclusionary. It's not inclusive. It is completely not, for all the reasons that I said last week, it is not an inclusive. There are so many categories of the population, categories is the wrong word, segments of the population, that wouldn't even be able to contemplate, wouldn't even be able to countenance the possibility of queuing. And for them, the fact that it's pitched as this magical thing and not just a means to an end almost rubs it in that they're not able to participate. Not only can I not get tickets to Wimbledon, but I also am unable to take part in this magical queuing experience.
Anybody can. They'll take a week off work.
David.
Have their holiday at Wimbledon. Like I remember I did.
Okay, but you were a student. I was a student when I did it. You know, not everyone has that luxury. It is a huge, huge luxury. And this is anecdotal evidence, but I have spent a lot of time looking at the queue, walking past the queue. We recorded podcasts and Facebook Lives from the queue last year, David, and it is not a diverse cross-section of society. And I find that a shame. Now, obviously, you know, tennis in this country is it's an expensive, predominantly white, middle-class sport. And I hope that is changing as the world changes and those are facts. It's not Wimbledon's fault that's the case, but Wimbledon could do more to change things, I think, to try and make it more inclusive. You know, Wimbledon is the only Grand Slam that doesn't have a kids' day. And most people probably don't notice that it has a kids' day. And you know, I'm not interested in kids' day. When I'm at the other slams and I realise it's kids' day, I actively try and avoid it because there's nothing worse than, you know, thousands of screaming young children that you don't know. There are individual children children that I don't know being loud and annoying, absolutely not. But it is... they are so, so powerful those days. I'm always blown away by the expressions on the kids' faces, the things you hear being uttered by kids and families on the way out. You know, I've genuinely heard kids wandering round Melbourne Park at the Australian Open on Kids' Day going, "Oh my God, I've just seen whoever it is, Victoria Azarenka, and she's the coolest person ever, and I want to be just like her." Or, you know, "I never knew tennis was this cool or fun." And just, you know, the expressions on kids' faces, they are an incredibly powerful experience. They create tennis fans. And Wimbledon doesn't have a kids' day. I know that there are complex reasons for that, that, you know, that we won't get into. And I wouldn't necessarily question the reasons, but... they could be doing more to make it a more, you know, there's no question. Maybe some people are brave enough to bring their young kids into the queue. I'm sure there are some hardy souls that do it. But there is no question, David, that it's not a child-friendly system of obtaining tickets to a sporting event.
Yeah, but it is only 500 people we're talking about out of a stadium full of more than 10,000
but the other way is to enter a ballot and have what, one in 10 chance. You can't.
Well, that's just same for everybody, isn't it?
Yeah, but
you enter, you get lucky or you don't.
Okay, but you can't say to your, you can't buy tickets for your 10-year-old son or whatever and say, "We're going to go to Wimbledon this summer. That's going to be great. It's something to look forward to, isn't it?" You say, "Look, I've bought you a ticket for a ballot," and you might just get lucky and get tickets for a day that you've not been able to choose, and then you'll have to panic about whether you've already got something booked on that day. And
demand outstrips supply, Catherine. Demand outstrips supply, so you might not be able to get that ticket for them anyway. Anyway, listen,
But that's the case for Beyonce concerts, David. And, nobody really complains about a straight-up, you know, just first-come, first-served ticket-buying system.
All right. Okay, well, we don't completely agree. Let's find out what you lot think at Tennis Podcast. Claudia, who's part of the sports marketing team at Sky Sports, says the queue is only a very small portion of show tickets, perfect complement to the way majority are sold via ballot or Ticketmaster. It'd be unfair if they were all sold this way, as not everybody can get in the queue, but it guarantees a portion of dedicated fans can make sure they see it.
Incidentally, she mentions Ticketmaster there. Only a tiny, tiny proportion go on Ticketmaster, and I believe that there are issues with the touts snapping those up, which is not remotely unique to Wimbledon.
Well, wouldn't that be the problem then if you did it more widely?
Well, I think less so. It's because it's such a tiny, tiny fraction.
Mm. Okay. Helen Barton Hansen says it needs to stay. Well worth the pre-dawn starts. I still write to a Canadian tennis fan I met in the queue in 2014.
I don't doubt that. I'm just saying I don't think individual good experiences justify the overall situation.
Stephen Malloy from Ballycorrick says, I love the queue, always will love the queue. No one will ever convince me not to love the queue. It'll be my fifth time this year.
But is it right? Is it right? I'm not saying, have you enjoyed queuing?
Who's to say what's right and what isn't? We all have our own opinion, don't we?
The greater good, David. the future of our sport.
51% have agreed with you, Catherine. So there's your greater good.
I don't think it is right. I think there is right and wrong, Dave, and I don't think it is right that somebody with mobility issues or a disability or a carer or a mother or, you know, a father or a whatever. I don't think it is right that those people are effectively excluded from this supposedly magical experience.
Okay, well, listen, first of all, here's a few people who, first of all, agree with you, and then we'll go on to hear what Wimbledon have said. Rosin from Bristol, who suffers from Lyme disease and other chronic illnesses, she says, I really appreciated what Catherine said. As someone who is disabled through chronic illness, the Wimbledon queue is a no-go for me. I do appreciate there are tickets for wheelchair users, etc., but the number available is usually pretty low for big events such as Wimbledon. Claire from Ireland says, my family flew from Ireland in the early morning last year, headed straight to the queue, weren't let in until 7 o'clock when the majority of play had finished. The queue is exhausting and frustrating. Get rid of it. Oliver says it's massively outdated and doesn't take into account any practicability of having to take 2 days off work to see one day's play. Now, I've spoken to Eloise Tyson, who works for communications at Wimbledon, and she's excellent. She's somebody we know well. She's always great to deal with, and she's been very quick to get back to me on a few of the questions that I had and to make a few points about some of the subjects we've been talking about. The 500 tickets for a start on centre court, same on court number one and court number two. That's what people queue for. There's also many thousands of ground passes that people can get. Basically, what Wimbledon are saying is they're trying to do it as fairly as they possibly can. There are less than 10% of the tickets for centre court and court number one given to the hospitality market. There are 2,500 debenture seats on centre court, which they use to upgrade their facilities. They use the proceeds of that, and 1,000 on court one as well. Obviously, if there's any surplus, once all the expenses have been taken care of, that gets passed to the Lawn Tennis Association and to the Tennis Foundation to try to improve and invest in the British game. The other elements, you talked about mobility impaired visitors and people that have issues such as those. Well, in the guide to queuing that is available on the Wimbledon website, these subjects are dealt with, and they say that they do encourage people that may have mobility issues to speak to one of their staff members about their individual circumstances, as there are provisions made for those people once they've collected their cue card. So there are no age limits. It's not like kids are not allowed to come. It is a question of whether you're willing to, or whether you're able to, or whether you feel you're able to. But there are some provisions made. There are certainly wheelchair tickets available, etc.
It's almost a test of how big a tennis fan you are, which, you know, for the likes of us, David, is fine. We pass the test.
What is wrong with that?
But it doesn't. But these are people that already love tennis. You know, it's not introducing any new people to tennis, or turning the casual, giving the casual passing tennis fan the magical experience that will turn them into a devoted tennis fan.
Demand massively outstrips supply. So,
yeah, but it's not unique in that respect for a sporting or an entertainment event of any kind. And yet, this combined system of ticketing is unique. And I know Wimbledon like to do their things their own way, and I think there are many great things about the queue, as I've said. But I think overall, we can do better. We can do better now.
Okay. Well, there we are. We've had our say. You've had your say. And Wimbledon have had their say as well. But do go to the Wimbledon website and you can get their guide to queuing if you want to read all about what they do and do not suggest you should do if you want to queue. And we'll see whether that ever changes in the future.
I think you, David, if you, as a defender of the queue, you should have to take your young children and queue for a week in a tent and entertain young children. Take the week off work.
I can get in as it is.
Yeah, you have to be like.
I did it. I did it for 4 years. What are you talking about? I've done it loads of days.
When you were a lazy student with no responsibilities.
Yeah.
Take your kids, it's awesome. David. You would take your kids, would you?
My kids would love it. My kids would absolutely love being in a tent.
Go for it then.
And I don't need to, do I? Because I can get in as it is. Why do I need to? Right.
Well, so lucky you.
Yeah, lucky me. It's brilliant. Right. Now, what's the worst surface that you've ever had a big win on? You've mentioned the Royal Albert Hall. For you, I've put that question out on social media, and do you know how I got to this question, Mark? I don't quite know how it ended up like this, but anyway, I was thinking about Kyle Edmund and wondering what his best surface was, what he would regard it as, and I suggested it might have been clay, and wondered whether who was the last British player, leading player, that might have regarded clay as their best surface. So hence, when I started texting Sue Barker. Sorry about the name dropping, everybody.
He's always looking for reasons to text Sue Barker.
So I texted Sue Barker and I said, because I reckoned that she was probably the last British leading player to regard clay as her favourite surface, given that she'd won the French Open in 1976. Well, alas, no. She says that her favourite surface was indoors. I said, how can that be? You won the French Open and you didn't.
How can that be?
Yeah, I said, how can that be, Sue? Come on.
Were you doing, was this text exchange last night, David?
Yes, it was, yes.
You're just spending your Saturday night texting Sue Barker.
Well, you know, maybe it brightened the day. Didn't sound like it. But she said that it was her most successful tournament, old surface, clay, but the indoors was actually her favourite surface. Now, when I questioned this and I said, how can that be, in that exact accent that you heard, she said, I beat Navratilova, Evert, King and Virginia Wade indoors. So, you know, and
humble
and
we brag. Know,
I was going to say, of all the people who doesn't do the humble brag, Sue Barker is at the top of the list. She is the most unarrogant person I think I know in the business. And yet, yeah, she just reeled off that list of evidence as well, why indoors was her favourite service. But there we are. And anyway, Sue's lovely. So thank you for that, Sue. But it did get me thinking.
She rescues stray dogs, David.
Yeah.
There's nothing lovelier in the world.
Sue Barker rescues stray dogs.
Yeah, so I've heard, yeah.
Really? No doubt. No.
She doesn't even make a song and dance about it.
No.
She just. But I'm doing that on
You're doing it for her.
Because I think that's just great.
She's got your vote. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So anyway, well, I wondered who had had the biggest win on their worst surface.
And, hang on, biggest single win, biggest
or,
single
you know,
result?
What's the biggest win you've ever seen from somebody on their worst surface?
Is Martin Verkerk going to be the answer to this as well?
No, it's not. Well, I mean, it's just your opinion, isn't it? So what is it?
I just wanted to record a podcast where Martin Verkerk came up twice. Well, I mean, my mind instantly goes to Tim Henman, French Open 2004. I know he reached semi-finals at two of the other slams as well, but that really, looking back, was his best chance of winning a slam. All those Wimbledons that casual tennis fans still hark on about him, you know, wimping out of or whatever the uninformed say, that was his biggest chance. He was a set and a break up against Guillermo Coria in the semi-final. Coria went on to lose to Gaston Gaudio in that final. It was a bizarre French Open year, and Tim Henman was playing some absolutely swashbuckling tennis on the clay. So that's what springs to mind. Also, just very, very quickly, when you posed that question on Twitter, I happened to be commentating on Alison van Ooytvanck against Camilla Giorgi in Lugano, and she looked like somebody that never wanted to see clay again in her whole life. She looked so uncomfortable on it. And she reached a French Open quarterfinal in 2015. I was watching the whole thing, maybe she was having an off day. I don't watch that much of Alison van Ooytvanck's tennis, but goodness me, I was watching it thinking, how did that happen?
So that's how Catherine beat me on that surface at the Royal Albert Hall. It can happen for anybody. This is the point of this talking point. And Hassan at Tennis Podcast says Andre Agassi at Wimbledon in 1992. And I mean, great shout, Hassan, because Agassi prepared for that Wimbledon by playing on a hard court, just practicing, no No warm-up tournament, nothing. Just went out there, started hitting, and won Wimbledon. Beat Goran Ivanišević in the final, beat John McEnroe in the semis, beat Boris Becker. I mean, incredible run. Caroline Norris, who, as you'll be delighted to know, is a guinea pig owner from Chorley, Catherine. She says...
Is that how she introduced herself?
On Twitter, now that I've stalked her and found out her profile.
Oh, that's her
that's bio.
I thought her tweet said... My name is, sorry, what was her name?
Carolyn Norris.
I thought she said, hello, my name's Carolyn Norris and I'm a guinea pig
owner.
It's late, David, guinea pig owner from Hampshire.
From Chorley. Oh, you're not doing very well here, are you? Right, let's finish it there. Sanchez Vicario is what she said.
I've got one eye on the plane to the Caribbean,
right,
David.
Yeah, 4 hours to go. Sanchez Vicario reaching 2 Wimbledon finals is what she went for. Clay quarter, of course, Sanchez Vicario. Dave from Livingston.
Conchita Martinez deserves a shout.
Yeah, that's come up a couple of times. Dave from Livingston says Maria Sharapova winning 2 French Opens. Good shout there. I like this one from Peter Kassin from Australia, who says Pat Rafter reaching the semis at the French Open in 1987, and he was chipping and charging, I'm telling you, on a pudding of a court, and it was slow as anything.
On a pudding. What did you just say?
It's a pudding, you know, like one of those squidgy things that just sort of, you know, there's no speed, there's no sort of slickness to it.
Is that a thing that people say?
Yeah.
Is that a bit of tennis lingo that I've... Hang on.
Puddingy.
Is that a thing that people say in tennis, or is that a thing that people say in Birmingham?
Both, Catherine, now that I'm in
specifically tennis in Birmingham.
Yeah. So anyway, he took a set off Bruguera, did Pat Rafter. Rafael Nadal, that bloke, reached, what was it, 4 Wimbledon finals? 5 Wimbledon finals between 2006 and 2011. Who'd have thought that? Djokovic beating Federer in 2 Wimbledon finals. That was impressive. Do you want to know what mine is?
Tell me.
Leighton Hewitt in Florianopolis, Brazil, on clay, on clay, beating Gustavo Kuerten in straight sets in the Davis Cup in 2001 and beating Fernando Medogeni and winning the doubles, 9 sets out of 9, Leighton Hewitt, I give you.
This is just your opportunity to gloat about the depths of your memory bank, David.
It's amazing, I tell you. So that's about all I've got for you, and I really enjoyed that talking point. We've also had Casey Delacroix, Catherine, just as a very final note, announce her retirement. And Casey Delacroix, always a good player to watch, had a great doubles career. I didn't know her personally, but she always came across really well whenever I saw her interviewed. Thoughts?
Yeah, it came across so well. Great doubles partnership with Ash Barty. I'm sure Ash Barty will miss her so much as a presence on the tour, but I think she'll go on to be a very powerful presence in whatever she chooses to do next. I think she could coach, she could go into politics. She's done a lot for LGBT issues in tennis and in Australia, which is going through a lot of change in that respect at the moment. So I think she will be a force for great good in her retirement one way or another.
Yeah, I think so too. Right, Catherine, you better go and get your plane. Otherwise, you're not going on holiday. And it's going to be glorious this week. So you're going to miss out on the good weather, having just stayed here for months in the bad weather.
I cannot tell you how grumpy I am about that. You can only enjoy good weather if you know that everyone else in the world is experiencing rain and misery.
I know that makes me
a small, small person.
It's looking a bit dicey where you're going.
I don't want it to be nice here.
Did you know it's not looking that great where you're going?
Don't say that.
It is looking a bit rough. But anyway, hope you have a lovely holiday,
Catherine.
Don't
want to see any pictures of you basking in the sun in Solihull, David. Yeah. I'm not interested.
Brilliant. If you would like to listen to our show next week, we'll tell you all about Monte Carlo. We have been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, with Eurosport, with our executive producers, Melanie Bowes, tennisballs.com, Triple S, our lovely mascot, Charlie the Ferret, who I've seen is packing for a holiday of his own. I think he's off to Monte Carlo. I saw his little tennis podcast sleeping bag in his case. So he's ready to go on Twitter if you want to have a look at that. We've also are partnered with La Manga Club, the wonderful holiday destination where Catherine is going to try out the forehand that she got from them when she's on her holiday next week. And we also have a special offer from them. If you didn't know already, 10% off holidays at La Manga Club. TPodcast18 is your code. We will be back, Catherine, very soon with another tennis podcast. Have a nice holiday.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.